Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
This series presents information based in part on theory and conjecture. The producer's purpose is to suggest some possible explanations, but not necessarily the only ones, to the mysteries we will examine.
Oh, this is In Search of...
boys and girls, that was probably my first introduction to the man we know as Leonard Nimoy.
Wow. Man.
As a kid, I didn't have as much patience for Star Trek, the older version initially. But goddamn, In Search of, oh yeah, I was up in that.
Looking back on it, are you a little bit weirded out with how fast and loose they played with facts?
Oh, I knew. I mean, as a kid, I knew they were like, I knew that. But is, you know, and becoming a young skeptic, like absolutely, it was Von Daniken, you know, Chariots of the Gods. It was BS. It was that, but it was so much fun.
Yeah, oh, definitely, man. I remember the entire family wanting to watch some Nadia Comaneci biopic, and I went to like the crappy television, the little black and white in the corner in the other spare bedroom to watch it In Search of by myself about all that stuff, because it was electrifying, man.
Yeah, so those of you who don't know, In Search of was a show hosted by Leonard Nimoy, and it was this, I think it was syndicated, and it would talk about all sorts of weird stuff, ancient aliens. You know, where did Amelia Earhart go? It was always these weird, fantastical things. It's like, imagine Weird Things if we weren't skeptics, you know, if we just believed everything. But it was fun. Dude. It was a fun show. And as some skeptics are like, yeah, I mean, you can certainly criticize it for not trying to find the truth. But if you sort of know how the world works, you're like, man, it's like Bigfoot photos, all that stuff. That was great. But the reason I wanted to start off with that was, you know, this week, just a few days ago, Leonard Nimoy passed away, and sadly, he is gone. But what an amazing life he's had. What an amazing life he's had, playing an iconic character, one of the most iconic characters you can ever imagine. Spock, who, you know, is as an important a figure as, you know, Darth Vader or Luke Skywalker.
Oh, easily.
And then do other things.
Yeah. Also, for the record, he lived a long time and made a lot of money. That dude lived long and prospered. Took his advice, that one did.
You can go to, if you're in LA and you go to the Griffith Park Observatory, there's an observatory proper, and below it there's a humongous basement, and there is a theater, a brand new theater, state-of-the-art theater, and it was started with a $1 million donation from Leonard and his wife to make that possible. And it's the story of the observatory told by him. So I am thrilled with the fact that he may have left, but every day, school kids, grown-ups, elderly, whatever, people from around the world can go sit in a theater and listen to him tell you the story in his absolute enthusiasm for Griffith Observatory. This is a guy that played an iconic role, also was an amazing director, but he lived a very big life. He did a lot of different things. He's left so many things for us to enjoy, and I wanted to start by sharing one of the things that he did that I really loved.
Dude, absolutely. 100%. Do we know what he passed away from? I mean, at the age of 83, I assume it's
lung. I think it was, let me look this
like,
up.
I guess the only thing that's significant is whether or not it was a, you know, an overnight thing or something that everyone saw coming.
Knew it was coming.
COPD is what they're saying. I don't know what that is. Cardio so, something.
Would you say that, you know, number one, Leonard Nimoy was somebody that came. Can you not hear me?
Yeah, it sounds like you're underwater or like it's.
He died of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, a condition he attributed to a smoking habit he had given up approximately 30 years prior.
Got it. There you go. Sorry, Justin's fixing his audio. We're not hearing anything just yet.
But he's a guy that's you look at, there is the role that he played, which obviously is important and it's iconic and it made possible because of the guy that he, you know, how he played him. And then there's the role he played in life, which I think is such an interesting thing to talk about. And, you know, it's one of these people that you hear, you know, people have, you know, very nice things to say, you know, that Walter Koenig revealed that Nimoy personally had advocated for equal pay for both, you know, Koenig and Nichelle Nichols on Star Trek. And that, you know, he was a person that looked out for other people, and that he's, you know, was able to get along with, you know, Shatner in his period when he was maybe not as able to get along with anybody else. He's a guy that just has done so many different things and, you know, has tried to help a lot of different people.
I never read I Am Not Spock and I Am Spock, but I always found it fascinating that after having his public presence defined by the character Spock, that he would kind of lash out against it and then to come back around to it. The only thing I know about I Am Spock is that my brother said that there's a passage in there in which he absolutely insists, hand to God, that that's Ricardo Montalban's chest and not a rubber fake amazing chest in Wrath of Khan.
I believe it's his chest.
I believe it. It does look fake and rubber as hell, though.
What's that?
Hey.
All right. I haven't read those books either, but yeah. What it seems to indicate to me as an outside observer is that the way that we look at those roles, at his role, Spock's role, you know, at Star Trek in general, has changed so dramatically in his lifetime that it is not, when he writes, I am Spock, it seems as if he is saying, I am so much more than a guy who played a character, right? And that he has these interests and he is joyful of Spock. You know, he obviously is somebody that, you know, he never really had the same anger as William Shatner seemed to exhibit of like, no, I am an actor. I just played this thing. And then later kind of they both sort of found peace within it. Leonard Nimoy seems like he is the blueprint for which we look at and almost expect as a nerd genre community of the people that play roles now. You know, like, it's not enough that Nathan Fillion plays Captain Mal Reynolds if he retweets something that, you know, a prominent science figure or Neil deGrasse Tyson says, everybody flips out because we want them to be these people. We want them to be people like us. Leonard Nimoy was people like us before we were ready to admit that we were people like us. And this is the stuff that we wanted to talk about on a large mainstream level like it is now.
When you say this stuff, you're talking about his contributions in the In Search Of type of things, or geek culture?
In living within this genre, you know, or living within like this frame of reference in science, in the Griffith Observatory stuff. If this happened now, let's move all of this up to now and say that 10 years ago, Leonard Nimoy starred in a huge genre-defying sci-fi series, and then he put $10 million toward, you know, this big expansion of the Griffith Observatory. It would be legend making amongst, you know, our Twitter, Facebook sphere today, right? Like, these are the kind of things that if, Edward James Olmos who gained fame in Battlestar Galactica, amongst many other things, or Blade Runner, if he did something like that, we would be like, oh my God, what a cool and more awesome person he is, because he echoes these interests that we have.
Was that a big public thing or how when he donated $1 million to the Griffith Observatory?
I didn't know until I went to the observatory and I saw that they had a theater named after him. And then I read the story on it and found out that, I mean, he's in it talking about it. I didn't realize his involvement for it. And not having read either of the books, but from my understanding, the first book, I'm Not Spock, came out like 1975. You know, it's less than a decade since Star Trek, you know, had just been off the air but was still in circulation. He's still so close to it, and it's like, oh yeah, this thing, and it's hard to know. You're in the middle of this. He came back 1995, you know, 20 years later, and writes I Am Spock because something happened. Star Trek became bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. It wasn't just a thing that nerds talked about in 1975. The character Spock, he first wanted to say, listen, this is Spock. I'm not this guy. I'm a guy who played this guy. And not a thing like, I don't like this guy or whatever, but it's like, this is them. He did, when he wrote I Am Spock, it was to, hey, you know what? Spock was a character that I was, you know, I was supposed to cast to play, and it was the ideas of a lot of people what he should be. In the almost 30 years since then, a lot of who Spock was has now become part of me. And that's what I think is really interesting, the idea that, yeah, I played that role, but there's so many qualities about that role that, that you know, I have now incorporated into myself, and that, you know, that he, you know, says, no, I guess I am Spock to a degree. Spock and I are sort of similar. And then you look at when he played Spock again in, like, the Unification episodes of Generation, and you look at, you know, where he was able to go with the J.J. Abrams movies, and you see where the humanizing element of Spock and what he did with Spock in I love the Undiscovered Country, by the way, which he directed. Or he didn't direct. No, he did Voyage Home. But I love the Voyage Home. You look at what literally anyway when he directed that film, that Star Trek film, and what he made Spock be and kind of the reinvention of that and the human side of it. It was a lovely, lovely merging of those personalities he talked about later on in I Am Spock. But I just want to get at, like, you can live a very, very full life that's beyond just the thing. And some of the most interesting things that he did were the things he did as a human being. I mean, it gave me great joy just to sit down in this theater and watch him talk about his love of, you know, this is a guy that didn't search of that wacky, weird stuff, but now his real legacy is in this wonderful place of science, encouraging people to have an appreciation for it and enjoyment of it.
Well, also, at the point that he writes, I am not Spock, I would take a guess that his daily existence as an actor in Los Angeles, the, you know, blowing up as a genre actor on a show that, you know, was looked at as, you know, popular among the nerds, is more of an albatross than, like, now where I think, you know, like you said, it got bigger and bigger. Now it's something that, like, presidential candidates will say as, like, affirming cred that they are, like, hip with a very current pulsing element of our culture. Mm-hmm. It's a whole new thing that, like, when, as soon as you added in this 30 years, 40 years of longevity, that these characters are not just this thing that, you know, a subsection of people enjoyed, but rather enduring elements of American folklore, that changes the game.
And part of it too is what's helped is that, as genre, sci-fi fantasy genre has become one of the biggest, you look at all the tentpole films now and you look at that, as that has become the biggest driving force, when you do those sort of sci-fi or fantasy or superhero kind of stuff, you're not on the margins anymore, you're right in the mainstream. And so, oh yeah, you're the guy that played this. Well, guess what? People who watch this also watch this other stuff. You look at the casting on the CW shows now and how they're, you know, they're going to do like a Supergirl series and they're bringing in people who've, you know, known for genre roles and say, well, let's hire them because there's an automatic build-in with, you know, the fans when they see people like that. And so I think that's the upside, is that it's not just the cheap, you know, now that it's become high, you know, the sort of the high margin product we create.
Do you think we're seeing nerds become the new jocks? Like, is this a case where mainstream is not only being contributed to by, you know, geeky, you know, internet subculture genre stuff, but maybe, you know, shaped by and dominated by? And if so, what becomes the fringe in this world?
How do we define a nerd?
I mean, the nerds are the disenfranchised, right? I guess by definition, they're the disenfranchised. And now, you know, everyone loves to call themselves nerds and geeks. They're very powerful. And now they're in this holier-than-thou, you know, the whole, you know, fake gamer girl thing. And it's like, you know, no, you're not liking it the right way. We're seeing some jock-like bullying from the nerd crowds because they finally have a little bit of power.
I think that's hard to say because I think we're – You immediately get into self-selecting of, like, what is a jock? You know, like, is a jock somebody who likes sports? Is it somebody who bullies? You know, and what separates somebody who just quietly, the fat kid who quietly played defensive end and all the same.
Like the programmer of that whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, like,
I haven't seen that.
It's, I think,
you know,
it's,
that's a whole thing. The programmer, that's a new thing. It's the
San Francisco. I am well aware of the programmer sub.
Brian, it's, you know, let's explain to Brian here, you know, what that is. Like, it's like a real type in programmer. It's the jock who programs.
And you see, that's a huge element of Silicon Valley. You know, Silicon Valley is like looking at this kind of stuff. You know, within even like what is supposed to be this kind of nerd nirvana of, you know, the geeks won and created their own companies. And yet now here are these other people that they might not be wearing Abercrombie and Fitch, right? But they are still, they are within this culture and they're there for I don't know. I guess the label stuff, I think, kind of
I'm not interested in labels so much as the shifting.
But I'll tell you where that label came from, though. This is why this exists. It used to be when you were a geek or a nerd and you were doing your thing, you were doing your thing alone. You were by yourself in the middle of nowhere because nobody else around you did that thing like you, and you did not have the social skills. You did not have a hierarchy. You were a guy there, then maybe you existed in some sort of online forum or something like that. But as nerds, as this technology, as this has become the driving force of the economy and the way the world works, and we collaborate and you work and you put a bunch of them in a room together, you're going to get, okay, well, we're not always going to be socially inept anymore. We're going to be, you know, we're going to learn to cooperate or get along or do this. And you're also going to get the different kinds of, it's going to be the lunchroom cafeteria. You know, they're going to get the bros over here. You're going to get the different groups and personalities. And that's what's happened as nerds have been able to gather together and other people identify with it. You start to see this emergence of things like the programmer of like, yeah, program, but like, man, we're going rock climbing this weekend, you know, we're gonna go to the gym and all this, and you know.
Yeah, I guess what I mean, I'm not so much interested in categories and social cliques so much as you know, the type of, there was something if you were if you felt powerless that was empowering to watch Star Trek, you know, and that attracted you to characters like Peter Parker and to the Marvel comic book universe, and it was because you felt like you were not in the mainstream that made these things so attractive. But now we live in a world where I mean, is The Avengers the highest grossing movie of all time or somewhere close to it, right? Like those same things, okay, those same things are the mainstream. They are what everybody, like if you don't like the Avengers, then you're the disenfranchised. You're the weirdo who doesn't like what everyone else likes. That's what's fascinating to me. Like by the numbers, you know, what was the fringe loner, the type of material that appealed to them is now what appeals to the mainstream. So I wonder who the new folks on the fringe are that will be defining, you know, culture 20 years from now.
I guess, but here's the one thing I would say about that is that we have experienced such a splintering of all cultures that it's not necessarily that we have that the genre culture has necessarily, I mean, it's certainly grown like physically, but it has grown greatly in influence because it was hardened kind of before culture in general split, before it was, you know, there was just a few main troughs that everybody got information and therefore gatekeepers could say, nah, this is just a little thing. You know, we don't want this kind of entertainment on here. We got to appeal to the masses. As we've seen culture split, I feel like genre culture has become more influential because there was always definitions to it. And now in a world where there are so many different messages, we can all latch on to these properties that many of which have been around 30, 40 years. People have these long relationships with, and you know, they are, that signal is just more clear because there have been these communities that were formed from distress, many of them, because
I think when we talk about too, like there's the technical side and the cultural side. When we talk about a lot of the cultural side of, you know, what nerd stuff, all that, it was things that was considered childish years ago for an adult to be into. It was, if you know, like we all, yeah, Star Wars was huge when I was a kid. If you were a kid, now it's big. So I think if you want to say what do kids really like that adults go, no, that's childish.
Yes, that's, yes, silly. That you nailed it. That's what I was seeking to discover. And the moment you put it in those terms, it's so clear to me that it's the Minecrafts. It's the, you know, it's the, you know, I mean, I guess you're kind of seeing like Lego movies right now is, you know,
did you hear what they're doing with Star Wars?
No, wait, are they going to do a Lego movie Star Wars?
Dude, they're doing all six films as Lego versions that they're going to be airing leading up to the new movie coming out.
Oh, wow. This is all on television then, right?
Yeah, I assume so. Yeah. But they're going to do Lego versions of this. And it's fascinating. So I think it was like Chris Anderson in his book Free talked about his kids like to watch. They preferred to watch other kids making their versions of Star Wars using Legos. And he's like, hey, this is an opportunity they should look into. And next thing you know, they do the, you know, because they do the Lego Yoda Chronicles, all this. And now they're going to do that. But I mean, it's fascinating. Like, yeah, I look at this, the thing I'll say that's different now though, is that we are part of being, I think a good nerd is saying, hey, that's not my thing, but I like the fact that you have that. You know, that's really cool that you like that. You know, I'm not going to laugh at you that you do this other thing. That's cool. And that's what's changed. So it's going to be harder to have those really, really fringy things unless they're just totally socially unacceptable, because it's like, oh, yeah, that's weird. But the idea is accepting, is the idea of accept. Let's have a Dragon Con and have a parade, and you're going to see a ton of stuff you're not into, but be like, cool, you know? And that's like, I used to, you know, like guys who collect like old classic cars, it's beyond me. I drive by Bob's Big Boy every Friday night. There's a big classic car collection there. These guys just, guys and women, you know, have these cars there. I love that. And I've gone there and looked at it. No part of me wants to take a 1955 car and restore it and go show it off. I don't get it. I don't understand it. Right. But I love that people have that.
I guess the only exception to that universally is certainly, and I think it's less now, but there was like a genuine recoiling of horror among even the geek community at the idea of grown men watching My Little Pony, which again, you talk about like, well, that's supposed to be for kids. What are you doing liking stuff that's for kids, weirdos?
Girls.
You know, yeah. And for girls, which to me only made it all the more punk rock. You know, it's like what's more punk than saying, I genuinely don't care what you think. I'm going to do what you think is the most inappropriate, horrific, dumb thing for me to do, you know? And, you know, 30 years ago was dyeing your hair, you know, giant colors and shaving parts of it and spiking it all out or whatever. Nowadays, it's dressing up as Rainbow Dash. Or nowadays, you're also seeing a giant movement towards not just cosplaying, but cross-playing, where it's like everyone swaps gender and does different versions of it. It's like this. These are the fringier elements. Like as I'm working this out of my mind, that I think are only going to be more and more mainstream in the next 10-20 years.
Well, let me pitch this thing about the Brony culture to you. What if it's not necessarily defined by the fact that they had the bravery to do it? Because I think part of the Brony culture was that let's assume that the rest of the world doesn't understand. The strength of this is that our community is something that matters, is that, you know, there's the reason the whole friendship is magic element was like, no, we connect with each other and it doesn't matter what the outside says. We have us. What if the definition of what's different in 2015 or 14, 13 is that they were kind of assimilated into mainstream geek culture far faster than they may ever have been previously, where I think that they still get static, but like, I don't think in general you would see a lot of people spitting on the ground when somebody talks about bronies now compared to like the first 1 or 2 years when people when they first kind of came around. I think that's what's really amazing about it, that they weren't, it wasn't like what furries kind of never really hit that line. Now obviously there's a bit of a sexual dynamic to the furries that kind of you know, makes it a little bit more complicated than the bronies, but they kind of got stuck in this limbo of like, no, you're in the geek community, but you're kind of at the side here. we've got this adjacent lot for you. Bronies, I feel like, you know, they're more mainstream than I would have guessed that they would have been when I grew up. I thought that they would be closer to furries than, let's say, Trekkies.
I think part of it, of course, is, you know, that's a unique property in that they hired some smart writers that figured out very early on that they should be writing for adults who are watching, you know, yes, I definitely do find it remarkable that in such a short time the assimilation happened.
I'll be like, I know, like, I'm in the old guard here. When I saw this, I'm like, oh, it's like a bunch of gay guys are like My Little Pony. All right. And then it's like, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's that's a thing that I'm like, like it's not like there's like a big space 1999 like cult fan community, and it's actually like it's like a gay thing for some reason.
Interesting,
right? But like with the brony thing, it's like, yeah, heterosexual guys log it, and it's like overwhelmingly. And to me, it's like I don't get it. But that's awesome. That's awesome that these, you know, they like this. They get excited over, it's for girls. And no, it's for everyone.
Lot of it is that, like, they can connect with somebody. And it's a lot of the experience that, you know, I think for people who kind of were coming of age as the internet continued to dawn, you know, everybody has had, and I guess this will just be a normal rite of passage from now until forever, when you just found that rich vein of people who connected on the level that you wanted to connect on over the internet.
You know that's a wonderful thing we talked about in my pick earlier on Weird Things, which is Makers by Chris Anderson. And it's the ability now to find the people who like the things that you like, whether it's right now, the number one movie in the box office is 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah. Okay?
This movie existed because there was a Twilight fan fiction community. And, you know, that's where the story started. It was Twilight fanfic, it was characters in Twilight, and people were like, nope, you have something more interesting here than the vampire stuff. Get rid of that. And it became this phenomenon. And that was because of the ability to get feedback. What you have right now is a resource. What you have right now is a resource out there. Eventually, people are going to learn to make it so mass capitalize it and divide it up and diminish the value of it at some point. But right now, there's an it'll still have value, but there's an immense amount of potential right now waiting to happen if you start a community. And it doesn't have to be a lot of people, just a handful of people are actively into something to solve a problem, to promote or talk about something. Don't look at it as like, hey, how do I make money off this? You look at it as, how do I celebrate this? Chris Anderson created his robot drone company, which now, yeah, it's a big company, but he created that because he says, I would love to be able to make this device. I would love to be able to make this device. I will share everything I learned with everybody else, what they've learned. Stephanie Myers, people who contribute or people who create other stuff, you know, people who like start out there as fans of one thing and then start creating things like that. There's communities out there. If you want to write, there's Wattpad. You could go write your little novels, your little stories, your character stuff. And there are other people out there. There's so many different communities and so many abilities to create stuff out there. It's a great place to start. And I think it's amazing. I don't know how long it'll last.
That was one of my favorite parts of Bold, where he talked about community building and the ability to find something that resonates with enough people that everybody chips in and wants to crowdsource, the development of it. And that, you know, that's how stuff like, you know, the My Little Pony conventions came to be, is, you know, nobody said, I bet I can make a lot of money manipulating these guys. They, you know, they built the community and then the rest, you know, came out of that.
Have you followed the latest on the Hyperloop project?
No. What is the latest?
So a while back, Elon Musk talked about, you know, he had this idea for a rapid form of transportation, and that would be basically could revolutionize transportation. And the problem was, is that, you know, Elon Musk, his investors and all that were nervous because, listen, you got a rocket company, you've got a solar panel company, you've got a car company. Maybe you should just focus on, is like, all right, I'll tell the world what my plan is. And I'll let you guys figure out what to do. Well, what's happened is Elon Musk has ignited the imaginations of lots and lots of people. And he proposed this. People were quick to point out, you know, why this was not going to work or why it was problematic. But that was fine. Some other people got very excited. And there's a company called Hyperloop Transportation Technologies. And Elon Musk says anybody wants to use it, they can use it. They started off with a group of – they said, hey, we're engineers and other people involved in this. We'd like to make this thing happen. So they've created a company. They started developing their own plans for it. And they have a plan to try to actually build a test track. And, you know, they're going to do – you know, they're trying to – the way they're going to go about funding is, I think they're talking about maybe doing an IPO or whatever like that. So I don't – you know – we'll see how well that succeeds. But the point is this is one of the most ambitious technological problems of all time, is very likely going to get some kind of funding to some extent. And you're going to have a room of people sitting at desk working to solve this problem who started collaboratively across the internet.
I think all of that is rad and great. And I love the story of it. Also, it will never happen. There will never be a Hyperloop.
Why do you say that?
Because we don't need to get those distances that much faster than we do it right now. What we need is more productive capabilities while we're in transit from point A to point B. And there are situations that there's the high end and the low end. The low end, going 600 miles or thereabouts is good enough for most people if they can have, you know, awesome Wi-Fi while they're doing it, and they could get a lot done on their plane flight. On the high end, there are some people, the kind of people who booked the Concorde, who will need to go very, very fast from point A to point B, but they will be able to buy rockets to get them there in a very fast way.
I was, my mindset on Hyperloop was, well, we'll see. And then somebody made it. I heard one comment and I go, oh, yeah, this is going to happen. And I'll tell you, one is, like, I think that everybody wants to travel faster. Everybody wants to be able to travel faster. If it's cheap and it makes money, if it's cheap enough to do it, absolutely. You know, I go to San Francisco, I go to Portland. I would much rather get there in an hour than get there in 3 hours or 4 hours with good Wi-Fi. I don't want to spend that much time traveling.
If that is true, then explain to me the push for self-driving cars. I would rather take
these
a self-driving
all
car.
Solutions.
On, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, they're yes. Why is there only one answer in your future? Why is there only one answer to this?
I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that
I apologize.
The self-driving car, like let's say, for example, if there's two versions, you can drive yourself and you can go 70 miles an hour, or you can have the car drive and it goes 50 miles an hour. I would take the car driving and go 50 in a heartbeat.
Oh yeah, no. Yes, the answer to all these things is yes. I will tell you why I think we may see something like the Hyperloop. I'm not saying it's going to be between LA and San Francisco. Why not Dubai? Why not the China? You know, they're building high-speed trains. They're spending billions of dollars in these projects. I guarantee you we will probably see something like it. Not here at first. It won't happen here at first. Dubai, China, place like that, absolutely think that you're going to see something very soon in the next 10 years. You're going to see a fast project like that.
Let me ask you this, Brian. So whether or not – because I think part of – if you're going to make a bet on whether or not this is going to happen, you have to bet that a government, a state government, is going to get behind it as a solution, right? Because especially the Hyperloop is based on the idea that you are building it next to I-5 and stuff like that. And that's the way that you solve the price problem of trying to build railroad tracks and having, you know, Farmer John say like, oh, no, it's $1 billion for my land now because I know you're building a big thing. So – do you think that post a successful and a hypothetical world where we have a proof of concept that works and functions, and let's say we got two or three of them in Dubai or China or something like that, that in the way that we've seen bullet trains become popular on state ballots, that we would see something like this become popular on state ballots?
Yeah, I mean, once we go into the realm of hypothetical and we can envision a world where it doesn't cost anything more than current bullet train programs or whatever, then yes. But certainly in the climate in the United States right now, I would say that on the menu of faster ways to travel, that one has, I believe, the steepest price tag out of all of them, because it's not just like you want to build a rocket to fly around, build one rocket, get in the one rocket, fly off. You build a Hyperloop, you need massive cooperation. You got to build a thing that is maintained, that
it's
goes.
It's theoretically on paper, it's a hell of a lot cheaper than the bullet train, the high speed rail they're trying to build right now here in California.
I think that's a bad idea too.
Well, it's a horrible idea.
Yeah.
But guess what? They've already started building that.
Yeah, I don't think that'll get finished either. I don't think that's going to happen.
I agree. But they're already spending money on that.
Let me revise my prediction. It absolutely will get started. It absolutely will not get finished in my lifetime. I will say that.
The California High Speed Rail?
A Hyperloop that is, well, I mean, but again, you could define like a short, like, you know, 100-mile trip.
Well, take China, where they have parts of China where robot cars, nice. There's not enough space even to park those robot cars, and they've got to get millions of people in and out of cities really fast. Okay.
Yeah.
For China, like, I could see China building a 300-mile, 400-mile, 800-mile-an-hour high-speed corridor or whatever. I could see, you know, Dubai. I could see them doing this.
Yeah, I guess I could. But again, yeah, I'm thinking mainly of the United States. But you're right. You know, overseas where, you know, where you got government spending their money solving one specific problem, price be damned, then I can absolutely see that.
Well, and also if we are going to move, because to me, the idea of any kind of I go from one city to another technology has always kind of fallen apart based on, you know, if I'm going from San Francisco to LA, everyone drives in LA. You know, it's very
hard. Driving right now.
Yet. From one point to another without a car. However, in a post Uber Lyft situation, and you have to assume that that's where self-driving cars become, you know, bigger and better. That seems more reasonable. I mean, like, it just seems like, all right, I get to the Hyperloop. I can drive to the Hyperloop station. I can take the Hyperloop down, and now I'm not immobile once I get to.
Part of the Hyperloop is that you would load in your car and it'd be like a ferry that would drive your car down? Or?
Well, there was a mock-up in his original white paper on how that would be possible, but I don't think that's what anybody is trying to build right now.
Yeah. I feel like that one's off the dollar menu. It's one of the more expensive items. I feel like there are other items that will get picked up first. But again, foreign governments, I agree, will probably jump on this.
Brian, I think you make a very good point that, you know, at the point where you argue for it, we're already past like three or four hypotheticals. And if this were, you know, Professor McDingleberry, who gave this white paper, and not Elon Musk, who has, you know, the Elon Musk halo around him, I think we would probably look at the Hyperloop differently than the way that we look at it now. But all that being said, I think the promise of a functioning, super fast, one point to another mass transportation system, I don't think is necessarily cursed. I think that we want it in theory. It's just that every way that we do it now, it has been kind of dumb. And also in a cab only situation, it's just impractical. Like, even they did build one from Orlando to Tampa, which is like an hour drive, and it's just the dumbest idea ever, especially since you're going from like one commuter city to another commuter city where it's really dumb to get around, you know, and anything. And like, maybe with an Uber it makes a little bit more sense, but even then, why not just drive the hour as opposed to the, you know, like what do you really gain in saving those 40 minutes?
Well, and that's the other thing too, is think about, and maybe this is colored by the fact that I have a family, but it's like, you know, any form of public transportation is far, far less attractive when you're lugging crap for a vacation or a trip and taking kids with you. It's miserable. Like right now, the minivan is a space station. They've got entertainment in. We got the milk where it needs to be. We know where the diaper bag is. We know we are set in that little spaceship. We could go anywhere, and it's just a matter of how much time it takes from point A to point B. The idea of taking our spaceship, ripping out all the parts that we're going to need for a vacation, hopping on a Hyperloop to save ourselves, an hour or 2 hours more than a flight.
It's going to depend. I mean, the theory is the idea that you can put a lot more people through there than you can through a fly quarter. And, you know, when I travel, different legs, sometimes I see it's all business travelers. And when you can open up a quarter, if you could, in theory, open up a Hyperloop corridor between Los Angeles and San Francisco with a couple stations in between, it would do amazing things. Like a real, not the stupid bullet train they're trying. It would do amazing things for the economy because it becomes really practical to work and live in either city. You know, in theory.
Okay, so right now when you fly, it's what, a little more than an hour from San Francisco to L.A.?
Yeah, about an hour and change.
Okay,
yeah.
So let's say there's two stops along the way. This is the other thing too, right? Is there's no flybys? There's no. Well, I guess there could be theoretically, but what are you going to save? Literally 30 minutes. But even then, you'll have to stop for the stations.
There's a cost. There's a huge cost associated with that. There's the theory that you would, if you were able to run these like you did trains, then it's a hell of a lot easier to catch. You catch one of these like you do a train, and not like trying to. You show up and
you don't book it. Yeah, you don't book a premium fare or whatever. You just have your wristband and you walk in whenever you want. Yeah,
yeah, and then advantage, no, that makes sense. And, you know, obviously, usually when I travel, like security screenings is super fast because like I go non peak hours and stuff like that. And like last three or four times I've gone to the airport, there've been three people in front of me. And so you could think in an efficient system where they're different, run differently, perhaps maybe not the TSA, whatever. And like you get on trains, you don't go through any of that. But anyhow, point is like, yeah, it's like the idea is if you just show up and you hop on, and that's why like air taxis and things like that are interesting models, is that if you can just like, oh yeah, just show up at airport, I'll catch a flight. You know, I know that I'll get one. I know that I'll get on there. It changes the dynamic. But I think there's a lot of answers. Like I'm like you, like I'm excited about like a robot car that can go 200 miles an hour in a corridor on the highway, because that'll change. Like, yeah, let's hop into a car, sit back, kick back, and relax. But there are some technical problems that are still really, 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 really hard. Blizzards, well,
and again, like this is all stuff. Like, I do believe a lot of good will come from trying to make this work, and certainly a lot of problems will get it solved. That'll benefit, you know, all forms of travel out there. But yeah.
Well, and the core reason we brought this up though was to talk about how
your point of view certainly not unreasonable. To say, yeah, like, hey, this crazy idea that somebody is just building a test track for and probably wouldn't get near the attention if it weren't for the fact that Elon Musk is the one who said it will never happen. I feel like that is a safe the field bet, right? Like, right. That there are other more practical things that will happen before this.
The whole point was just to talk about the idea of crowdsourcing. When you bring a community and say that this was a project that was just pie in the sky, to now there's teams of engineers, and you know, who knows how, what their skill level is.
And this is this to me is the biggest and most exciting thing about crowdsourcing, is that it allows you to shoot for the moon in ways that nobody agrees
with. Literally, in the case of the Google Moon project.
Exactly. All of a sudden, it's like, you know, it's like, hey, it's great, entire world, that you don't believe us. That's fine. Also, we're just gonna go for it and have a good day. You know, it's like, that's something you don't get to do when you're trying to argue for it. It's like, no, this is a public works program. We need, you know, government money to blah 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 blah. Like, all of that goes away when it's like, well, you guys could talk and argue. We're gonna shut up and try it.
Yeah, it's wonderful, and I think that one thing too is that you don't have to be the lone inventor anymore. If you collaborate, you can get people on board, and you might meet somebody who's really good at mechanical engineering, you know, and it can help deliver your idea. You know, it's fun to look through Kickstarter to find some brilliant things, and then you see completely idiotic things that some guy's like, I have an idea. I think I'm going to put it up there and see if I find any money. And they put, you know, they sat at Denny's one day, drew it down there, and like, this is how I become a billionaire. And look at that. Don't be that guy. You know, be the person that believes in the idea, not what the idea will get you, believes in the idea and will either find the skills to make it happen or find the people to make it happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Out there.
Any questions? Anything? Anybody like, else want to?
So, well, if you'll sign up for our Secret Insider program where you can get 5 Hyperloops for every buyer.
Man, I was at a bar in Chattanooga and there's these two dudes talking. And he was like, oh, my God, I'm going to this great – I think it was the Rich Dad, Poor Dad. One of the Rich Dad, Poor Dad.
Guy Kawasaki. Or not Guy Kawasaki. No, different. Yeah.
Like things.
Robert Kiyosaki. Oh.
It was great. He taught me and he told everybody there how – and gave it the exact script – how you could get your credit limit upped by like 30 – you know, by $15,000, $20,000. And they had everybody walk out, and like everybody came back in, and they had $20,000 more of available credit, because that's what you have to do when you're like buying property, is you have available money and you're able to invest it. And I'm like, oh, and then what happened? He's like, oh, you know, we left. And I'm like, well, no, you bet you probably asked you, pitched you on like the special thing, you know, the way that you really get the secret sauce. And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm like, well, how much was that? Yeah. $10,000.
Now that you've got your credit limit increased.
Well, it's like you already agreed that this is a program. You've seen how spectacular the results are. In only minutes, we were able to double your credit. Now that you have that leverage, are you going to not use it to secure your future? Because if you don't believe that this works, why are you still here? You're here. You believe it works. You have the tools. Let's press that button, buddy. Let's get rich.
Oh, man.
So I'm going to tell you something that's interesting.
Is that a little too spot on?
Me and Brett did a Go game for a real estate seminar guru guy, and it's the only time. And I've done Go games for companies. I just did one for a company that I do not believe in their product, it is
penicillin.
Yeah, it is hard when that's the only one that made me feel icky, because like I see just these wide-eyed people, and like they remind me of people in my family that like have nothing but ambition and sometimes don't have quite the gumption to sit down and chart a better course.
Two things. One, once I was at a Denny's and I sat down and I'm eating and I hear this guy give an Amway pitch to this young couple in back of me. You know, oh yeah, you sign in, da-da-da-da-da. He got up and he left. I turned around and I said, listen, guys, It's none of my business, and I apologize.
Yeah.
But you know, you will never make any money on this, right? You understand that the only people make money who started 30 years ago, you know that, right? His goal is to sell you. He is selling you. You know, and they're like, yeah, you know, we figured as much. But I just like I had to say something.
Yeah.
I had another time. I was with a friend who was kind of a shady guy himself. I says, hey, I need you to come with me. I got to go talk to a guy about an investment thing. I'm like, all right. We go to an IHOP, another place where, you know, big transactions takes place. And this guy shows up and he's wearing like flip-flops, shorts, you know, Florida casual. And what it was, as he says, was telling my friends, says, you know, this is way back when, before the bubble burst and the whole dot-com thing, all that. He's like, listen, I've got what I'm doing is I'm looking for some partners. My son's a stockbroker at, you know, Goldman Sachs, whatever. And he tells me when the big IPOs are coming in. And what I want is I want people to invest my money. But the problem is you have to spread it around because, like, your broker will only let you invest so many shares, whatever. So I'm looking for people to invest my money because I get tips because you call them up and you say, I want this. Like, I can only give you so much. All right, whatever. Lays out this whole thing. And I'm like, I'm sitting there. I'm like, This sounds totally like how Warren Buffett did. Totally how Warren Buffett did it, right? and then I'm waiting for the pitch. And then he goes, I'm like, now, but, like, so I'll give you my money to invest. But to know that you're good, that you're on the line – you know, you put in $3,000 up front, and that way I know that you're serious about this, whatever, and I'll give you the tips because I'll call you up with the tips and tell you where to invest my money and all this, right? And my friend sits there and says, listen, what do you think? And I'm sitting in front of the guy, right in front of the guy, and he feels like a bit like, you know, Tony Soprano's brother-in-law-ish kind of guy. You know, there's an edge to this guy. There's a New Jersey, New York kind of angle, wise angle there.
Aggressive.
But I said to him, I said, right now, it is impossible for me to tell the difference between this and a scam. I said, he gives you his money, and then he waits for you to call back with his tips and then to tell you you're going to give him his money. You know, you're going to give him a bunch of money. This guy's response ignores me, just shuts me out and turns to my friend. And it's like, well, you know, let me know what you think, and da-da, doesn't answer, doesn't respond, does not do anything, shut up. Guy leaves. We go out in the parking lot. My friend says, what do you think? I go, it's a scam. It's a scam.
Do you remember the part where I said it sounds like a scam and then he didn't deny it?
Yeah. I mean, and it's – you know, you give him $3,000 and then you wait for him to call you up and say, hey, here's my money to this. I said – and the whole bullshit about how like, oh, yeah, I can't – you know, I can only – they won't let me invest it all in this that I need other people invest in. And so he's meeting people and random strangers in IHOP to tell you this. Yeah. And he's like, yeah, but what if it's real? I'm like, what? You know, my mind is blown here. And then I told my mom this, and my mom said something very interesting that stayed with me to this day. Because she knows the character. This guy's a guy who screwed over his own – my friend is a guy that has a bad reputation with his own friends and his own business and screwing people over. And this is the kind of scam he would run. My mom said, you can't cheat an honest man.
Yeah.
I'm like, you can steal from him, but you can't cheat an honest man. I'm like, that was – very, very, very interesting. You know, that was as I walked away from thinking about that, like, wow. And then I've had that happen. Like, I had an attorney friend of mine. He had a guy who was a successful executive, got one of those, you know, Nigerian scammers. And the guy was like, desperate to believe that this was real and like wanted to shut everybody else out, you know? And it's just,
in their latest book, Think Like a Freak, from the Freakonomics guys, they ask the question, why are those Nigerian 401 scam emails written so poorly? They're so transparently, obviously scams. And it turns out that there's an incentive because if you make them too good, you bring down too much heat. And if you but by making them crudely written and
well, it's also because of the spam bots filters.
Yes. But like by making them crude enough, you pre-qualify the type of people who are the ones who will respond to you. When you make it dumb enough are the ones who you will be successful. You don't want to access a more educated level of clientele. You want to make it as dumb.
All right, guys, I got to peace out here because Crackle's leaving and
for me. I got to go shoot stand-ups for scam school. Man, good after things, gang.
I've got to play with my whip.
Okay. Can we real quick just say, can you announce what you're calling him?
Oh, I don't know. I was just joking. I was going to call it the Thwip, but I think Marvel probably trademarked that.
Dude, I double check on that. He's got his Wolverine claws. He's calling them Snicked, and the Spider-Man rubber band shooter, he's calling the Thwip. I love this, man.
Yeah, I'll look up to see that. I'm giving away, so I'm not like charging for them. So I mean, just put the plans. We'll put all that online. So,
dude, I'm so excited. I think this will be the first project. I think Penny is working towards us getting a 3D printer. So,
well, yeah, my goal is right now. If you go to Thingiverse and other places, it's kind of thin on really cool stuff. A lot of ornamental things and like, make this toy you can buy for a dollar. I want to create cool stuff that you sit there and you go, oh man, I want to shoot rubber bands, or I want to poke my little sister's eye out with
freaking claws. All right, well, I know we got to go, so I guess I'll be the one to say it. It's been after.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.